It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Tony Evers signed 5 bills into law this week that aim to provide new recourse for victims of sexual extortion. It's a crime that Evers and the legislature made a felony in Wisconsin in December.
Often called sextortion, it's a form of online blackmail where someone threatens to distribute sexual images or videos if that victim does not comply with certain demands. Those events are on the rise, according to the FBI, especially among young people.
One of the new laws allows victims to file a civil suit against a perpetrator. Others provide 4 new positions and new funding aimed at combating internet crimes. And law enforcement will now be able to investigate exploitation with administrative warrants rather than judicial warrants.
To hear more about these laws, we have Justin Patchen, professor in the Department of Political Science and Criminal Justice at UW-Eau Claire and co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. Justin, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Glad to be back.
And Jesse Crow is with us, leader of the Wisconsin Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. He supervises those investigations in field offices in Wausau, Madison, and Eau Claire. Jesse, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us on the show today and bringing this matter to light because it's really important for us.
Jesse, we gave a very brief description of what we mean by sextortion. What does a sextortion case look like on the ground, and how much are you seeing that?
We're seeing an increase of it over the last 3 or 4 years. Last year, we saw over 650 tips that were received from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children on sextortion. We know those numbers are very low because victims and families are reporting it directly to local law enforcement. We do not collect those numbers. And so far this year, we've received over 235 of those leads. And then in the last couple of years, we've had at least 2 suicides of juveniles that are related to sextortion.
And Jesse, what does that case look like when it affects that kid, that family?
It's devastating. The suspects or the actors that go after these children trick them into sending images. The victim sends an image to the suspect. The suspect then uses those images against them, and it's a very, very high pressure sales. With a countdown timer telling the victim that their life is going to be ruined unless they pay money. A lot of children are in mental crisis after that. Some of them commit suicide. And it's just devastating for the families that are involved.
Justin, you've been studying teenagers and the internet kind of since there was an internet. Why are teenagers particularly vulnerable to this type of crime?
Well, you're right. They are particularly vulnerable, and it's sort of the confluence of adolescence and exploration with, you know, sexuality and interest in other people and technology, right? And they have easy access to other people, and they're interested in other people, and they're particularly vulnerable to these kinds of scams and exploitation because of their curiosity. And, you know, they want to be popular. They want attention to be paid to them. And Mr. Crow is right. We've seen it in our research as well. We started officially studying sextortion in 2016 across the United States. At that time, about 5% of the youth we surveyed, middle and high school students, had experienced sextortion. In 2025, just last year, that number was 15%. And when we first saw that, we thought maybe something was wrong with our data. Just had it increased so significantly. But then, you know, the FBI data is backing it up. The ICAC data is backing it up. And boys are more significantly likely to be targeted than girls, which is also interesting. So this is a huge problem.
Jesse, a law enforcement challenge, as with any cyber crime, if this is reported to a local police department, well, hang on, the actual perpetrators might be literally anywhere on the planet. How much of a challenge is that for local and state law enforcement?
It's very frustrating. So our main goal is to get services to victims and to try and identify perpetrators. If they are overseas, we try and work with our federal partners to get them that data, but that brings a lot of prosecutional issues with it. And so the victim support, the family support is really what we aim to go after for these types of cases, to make sure the victim knows they're not alone, that they have help out there, and that their family supports them and law enforcement is going to support them.
Looking at this new package of legislation, I want to ask each of you what stands out to you as maybe particularly meaningful or impactful. Justin, let's start with you.
Well, I think the enforcement mechanisms, they're important, and certainly the more resources to the Department of Justice across the state to investigate these issues is really important. But I was particularly happy to see an emphasis on an encouragement for the Department of Justice to basically educate people about this issue, whether it's students in schools or families and communities. There, more education is needed, and it seems like there's an emphasis on that. But it needs to be research-based, too. It needs to focus on, you know, these sort of developmental concerns, because the biggest issue is students find themselves in these positions because maybe they made a mistake. They've been told time and time again, don't share explicit images, and they made that mistake, they did it, and now they feel trapped. So we need to open up that line of communication and, you know, make it easier for these young people to confide in adults to get this really serious problem solved.
And Jesse, what stands out to you in that new legislation?
So the new positions and the use of the administrative subpoena are very valuable to us. So the positions are going to enhance our analytical pool. So our analysts here at the Department of Justice, they interact with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They triage and take all of the cyber tips we get from the National Center. Last year, we got over 19,000 tips from the National Center, and all those have to be viewed by personnel here. So that will help immensely. The second is the digital forensic examiner position. That's going to help with capacity for our forensics unit in processing computers and processing evidence from local law enforcement and our investigations to get that information out quicker. And then lastly, that outreach position. And that's going to be extremely valuable. Dr. Patchen is absolutely correct. Outreach is what we need to do. We have a really good anti-sextortion campaign right now where we provide posters and resource cards to communities, law enforcement, schools, and that will absolutely continue because of the statute. But we have success stories in showing how good the outreach is. Just in the last week, we've had two tips that we've received from the National Center on sextortion, where one, the child said that he had learned about sextortion and the dangers of it and knew not to get trapped by it. And the second one is a victim used a QR code on one of our resource products to actually file the cyber tip with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So we know that the outreach is working. And having a dedicated outreach specialist is going to be amazing for the state of Wisconsin and the messages that we're getting out to the communities.
We're talking about sextortion in Wisconsin with five new bills signed into law this week on the issue. Justin Patchen is with us, researcher at UW-Eau Claire. Jesse Crow with the Wisconsin Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. This law earlier or late last year that made sextortion a felony is called Braden's Law after 15-year-old Braden Bone, a Cronenwetter teen who died by suicide after becoming a victim of sextortion. Last year, we talked to Braden's mother, Brittany Bird. Here's some of what she had to say.
I wish that it wasn't our story that had to make this happen. But if it can save even, you know, one more kid from going through this, one more family, in our case, it won't affect our case specifically because it'll be a federal case. But our hope is that it will be a warning to these predators. Like, not in Wisconsin, not here. Not our kids. This is what can happen.
Jesse, are you hopeful that felony designation and that states like Wisconsin and others are putting more resources into this could be a deterrent for the perpetrators?
It definitely can be, and it allows us to prosecute individuals within anywhere in the United States, which is very helpful, having a standalone crime for sextortion itself. And then that new law that was just signed by the governor allows us to use our administrative subpoenas to enforce or to get subscriber data for sextortion cases specifically, which is going to be very, very helpful in getting those resources to victims and identifying suspects.
Justin, if you can talk directly to families concerned about this issue, it seems like the key thing as a parent here is a kid in this situation is going to think, I screwed up. I did something I know my parents didn't want me to. Therefore, I'm not going to take this to my parents, right? The message is, yes, take that to your parents. How can families talk about this and convey that message?
Well, you're exactly right, Rob. And this is an opportunity, right? These laws that just passed is an opportunity for parents to have that conversation with their kids. It's not an easy conversation to have, of course, because you don't want your children, you know, participating in these kinds of behaviors necessarily, but you also want to protect them if they do. And again, these, especially these international bad actors, are very skilled at coercing kids into doing things they normally wouldn't do. So you have many examples across the country and here in Wisconsin where you know, children who are really good kids just find themselves in a terrible situation. And so we need to open up that line of communication. It seems like it's getting better. I think the awareness campaigns are working. So even in 2016, when we first studied this, only about 40% of the victims of sextortion told an adult about their experience. Now it's about 57%. That's not enough. That means almost half of the kids who are targeted don't tell adults about their experience. But, you know, at least it's moving in the right direction. So the key is opening up that line of communication. And as a parent, you might not know what to do, but at least being there for your child and working through this issue with them is hugely important.
And Jesse, let's take that next step. The parent, the kid has come and said, hey, this is happening. The parent doesn't know what to do, who to report it to. What do you tell parents when this is happening in their family?
Yeah, the best thing to do is to contact your local law enforcement to report it, but then also contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at cybertipline.com. And they can report it directly to NCMEC, and we will get it here at the ICAC task force as well. And to remain calm, and that's the big message we give to parents. You're going to be upset when your child does this, but remain calm and provide support to them because they were tricked into doing this by those bad actors.
And that's a good place to leave it. Jesse, thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having us on and bringing this issue to light.
And Justin, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks. Happy to do it.
That's Justin Patchen, professor in the Department of Political Science and Criminal Justice at UW-Eau Claire. He's co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center. And Jesse Crow is commander of the Wisconsin Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. He supervises those investigations in field offices in Wausau, Madison, and Eau Claire. We've been talking about a set of new state laws just signed this week targeting sextortion online. If this has been an issue affecting you, your family, your loved ones, and you're willing to share that story, let us know. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, it's been a big week with spring election results and what happens next for the universities of Wisconsin as the board fires UW President Jay Rothman. Our politics team breaks it all down in this week's edition of Inside Wisconsin Politics from WPR and PBS Wisconsin. That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It was a big Tuesday in Wisconsin politics. Wisconsin voters overwhelmingly elected appeals court judge Chris Taylor to the state Supreme Court. It secured a liberal majority on the court for years.
Also on Tuesday, the Universities of Wisconsin Board of Regents fired its president, Jay Rothman. To understand what it all means, we turn to political reporters from WPR and PBS Wisconsin.
It's the latest installment of Inside Wisconsin Politics. Joining the discussion are WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
We've kind of gotten used to these big liberal blowouts, we'd use the term, in these April elections. They have figured out how to win these races. It seems like Chris Taylor, though, took that to a new level with her race this time. Anya, what's, I guess, stuck out to you about this massive win by Chris Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're also used to talking about Wisconsin and so purple, and elections are frequently decided by less than a percentage point. And then we've had these spring elections that are determined by closer to 10 points, but this time it was 20 points. And so that is such a significantly larger gulf. So we kind of saw, you know, some of the tea leaves leading into the race, less spending, sort of less excitement across the board. The stakes were different. But Zach and I were chatting on election night. We were waiting around at Chris Taylor's, what turned into her victory party. And we were saying, you know, this will be an interesting experiment to see with the sort of pulled punches, the pulled financial punches, what kind of margin will we see. And then it turned out to be the largest margin I've ever seen, and from what I understand, in decades in Wisconsin races.
Yeah, a 20-point margin as opposed to the usual, quote-unquote 10 in these races. Zach, how about you? What stood out?
Well, just to add on to that, earlier that afternoon, I met up with Chris Taylor on the UW campus, and one of the questions I asked her was, are you worried because of the lack of investment from the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, which in past elections has sent millions of dollars to their preferred candidate, or from outside interest groups who really spent nothing, that you're leaving possible voters at the door who may not be aware they need to get out and vote? And she said, no, I don't think so. And she was absolutely right. And I think what this showed was that both sides knew where this election was going early on and decided we're going to save our money for the fall. There's enough to spend it on there between some very tight assembly races, obviously the governor's race, and even some competitive Senate races that may not be fully decided, that may determine the margin for either party in that chamber, that I think they all kind of walked away from this to the point where when you saw Lazar at her party, you got the sense that this was not a surprise to her. She wasn't shocked, maybe at the final margin, but even hearing from Republican voters afterwards, there were a lot of them saying, well, why weren't we trying harder? And I think that was the main takeaway, is that everyone had an expectation that this was going to be the result.
Rich, as we sit here today, what kind of stands out to you about this race?
Well, kind of jumping off what Zach just said, there was a sense that the Republican Party of Wisconsin really wasn't trying very hard in this race. They're nonpartisan races, but also they're not in a lot of ways. So the level of fundraising and money coming from the state party or third party groups aligned with conservatives just never materialized. And you've seen a lot of conservative people on social media saying, what are you doing, Republican Party? You know, there was a lot of anger about that, but also people didn't really love the way that Lazar was campaigning. They wanted some more aggression out of her, some more of a Schimmel type. So he's the conservative that ran last year, much more political generally than Lazar. She stuck to the experience kind of mantra. And so it did seem like, you know, all the money was lower in this race than it was in the past, but really Republicans kind of stood down in a way.
Rich, we were kind of trading messages throughout the night as you were at that Maria Lazar campaign election party. It strikes me that this was not a joyous affair. Can you kind of talk us through what it was like to be at this hotel in Pewaukee?
Yeah, it was, there was no celebration. In fact, there was no people. Generally, when I show up to these things, we get there early and then, you know, you set up, but there's already people milling around. For much of the night before the race was called, there were more reporters in the room than there were supporters. And that is just something that and you kind of get a sense that, well, they kind of know this is a foregone conclusion. But even I was still surprised when the race was called less than 40 minutes after the polls closed. I mean, that's surprising. So the mood was rough. Lazar didn't come out and speak until after 9 p.m. She said that she feels that she ran this race with purpose. There was still a reason for it. She said that she thinks that her message that partisanship should get out of these judicial races kind of resonated, and that with candidate after candidate in the future sticking to that message, maybe things will change. Whether that squares with reality, I'm not sure.
Seems like the results might send the opposite message there in terms of what future candidates will take from it. As you look at where the votes came in here, I know we should take them with a huge grain of salt because we do not have 20-point elections in Wisconsin. That said, they are a snapshot in time at this moment. Anything stick out to any view about where the votes came in or how they came in?
I mean, I think that the grain of salt is actually kind of part of the story, right? There was a lot of trying to claim victory and really cast this forward from Democrats, cast this forward into November for what this means, especially because Chris Taylor performed so well in so-called Trump counties and up north and things like this. But that's in part because liberals have the advantage in these spring elections. That's been true for the last couple of years. That was true in the sort of postmortem that Republicans put together about their own poor performance last spring. that the nature of the electorate that comes out in an off election in the springtime without Donald Trump at the top of the ballot is a really different electorate that comes out in a November election. And so I think overreading the results of this would be a problem for Democrats.
Yeah, I think the extension of that is that we're not going to see the same environment in the fall. Republicans won't be outspent 8-1. Republicans won't be pulling their punches and not trying to campaign through the end. And nothing to diminish the campaign that Maria Lazar ran, but she ran it without any of the outside support that is necessary in this modern environment for a Supreme Court candidate to be successful. She simply didn't have the party infrastructure that is now relied upon if you want to win a statewide campaign. That is a completely different game than what we're going to see this fall. And yes, I think Democrats were sending out statements trying to fire up their own supporters. But I saw this game a couple years ago in 2023 when Janet Protasiewicz won. I was in Ozaukee County the next year, and Ozaukee County Dems were telling me, oh, we were in the mid-40s in Ozaukee County for Janet. We're going to win for fall of 24. Kamala Harris is going to win Ozaukee. She got blown out. Like, things revert back to the norm when you get to the bigger elections where more attention is paid. And due to voter realignment, like you were just talking about, Anya, we're going to see more people that don't pay attention to these elections vote in the fall. Not at the same level as we would in a presidential year, but turnout will be significantly higher. Right now with realignment, Democrats do better in lower turnout events when they can consistently get their voters to the polls and Republicans aren't. So a lot of it will depend on the atmosphere this fall and how demoralized Republicans may be.
Yeah, I would be surprised, you know, frankly, if Republicans were able to win Ozaukee County in November. This is the O in the wow counties, the vaunted wow counties that were the foundation of Republican power in this state for years. But I have to say, Chris Taylor won Ozaukee County. And that is something that even in these other big Supreme Court elections, the liberal candidate has not yet won Ozaukee County. She also got 84% in Dane County. And yeah, sure, Democrats win Dane County. No surprise, she's from there. 84% is unheard of. And when it is the leading vote-getting county in the state, as Dane County is in these races, that's a big deal.
Well, and she did much better in her home county of Dane County than Maria Lazar did in her home county of Waukesha County. And Waukesha County is also one of these that has started sort of moving away from being as diehard red. It's still deep red, but that is also a sort of suburban district that we've been paying attention to as some of those shifts have taken place.
Far more people than Ozaukee, too. So a big vote getter. Rich, how about you?
Yeah, I just wanted to go back to the discussion of, you know, you've got the wow counties, not as as deep red, but northern Wisconsin. So it is true that I've seen some conservatives say, well, that's the new wow counties, essentially, you know, a strip of counties from like the eastern side of the northeastern part of the state to the Polk County on the west. And that might be true, but the population just isn't there. So, you know, that sort of an area, even if it goes hard for Republicans in the fall, a Dane County kind of turnout like we saw could erase that pretty quickly. So that was a really interesting thing to see Republicans say, well, this is where we need to focus up north.
So we have this thing that we do in Wisconsin. At least I can't resist it. We had an election and we have to talk about what's it mean for the next election. And I know the 2026 election is way different, but what does it mean? I mean, are there lessons that either party would look at these and say, well, that's troubling for us, you know, if you're Republicans or if you're Democrats, a little of that exuberance that you were talking about. Is there anything kind of real in there?
Well, just today, before we came on here, we saw two more Assembly Republicans announce they were not going to seek re-election. Now, in and of itself, that doesn't mean anything, but trends matter. We've seen a lot more Republicans decide they don't want to run. And we've seen that in the Senate, where it is a pretty good odds-on chance that Democrats will flip that chamber and the Assembly's 50-50. It sucks to be in the minority. And we've seen that in both the legislature and on the Supreme Court, where we had now two consecutive conservative incumbent justices who were well within the normal age range to seek another 10-year term decide, I don't want to be in the minority on this court. I'd rather go somewhere else. So I think those patterns tell you a lot more than what any of the press releases will.
Including Annette Ziegler, who would have been up for election in 2027, and somebody who at least in 2007 showed that she knew how to win these races. How about 2027? What does this mean for the next state Supreme Court race? You know, who wants to go there?
I mean, it's interesting, right, sort of gaming out the next couple. We talked last week about how nobody was talking about this court election as the most important in a generation or whatever. And then enter Ben Wickler, the former chair of the Democratic Party. He sent out this email day of, and he was explaining why he thought for Democrats and liberals it was actually hugely important, because essentially this guarantees liberal control past the point of the census, and so into the next redistricting cycle. Everything comes back to redistricting, as Zach likes to say. And so with the next, with the 2027, with 28 and a swing justice potentially coming up, maybe we'll see primaries in the races again. Like, in some ways, this opens the door for some very strange maneuverings as liberals and Democrats get to kind of take for granted that they have this court.
Rich?
I'm going to be watching to see if Republicans or conservatives even run a candidate. You know, that the inverse of that happened when the GOP was running the table on these elections. And there's been a few, you know, talk radio people wondering, like, who would want to run for a seat in the minority of the Supreme Court after someone just got clobbered by 20 points. So I obviously can't predict the future, but that seems like it would be a pretty bitter pill to swallow. So it will be interesting to see who runs for liberals and for conservatives, or if they just sit this one out.
Yeah.
All right, Sean, your turn. You don't get out of this.
Hey, I mean, I've been thinking about how long this could go, really, in terms of how long this liberal majority could be in place, because yes, we have said accurately that conservatives could flip it back in 2030. But you know how much has to go right for them for that to happen? They have to win next year when there's an open seat, and we see what the environment is now. They have to win in 2028 when Rebecca Dalit's up and she knows how to run these races. 2029 is Brian Hagedorn, who may face a challenge from the right. And then, if all that goes right, then you get to 2030 and you presumably take on Jill Karofsky, another double-digit winner in her race. If any of those things does not go their way, the clock gets set back 3 years. So this really does sort of open up a chance for liberals to look at the court with a long view. And I think we're kind of looking for clues on how they might view that now that this 5-2 majority is the sort of new reality. We know about Judge Chris Taylor, the candidate for Supreme Court. She gave us some hints on election night about how she views the law. Here's Justice-elect Chris Taylor.
The law can be a tool to lift people up, to improve their lives, to strengthen our communities. And that's exciting. That drove me to law school. And I've spent now my 30-year legal career as a lawyer in private practice, as a law and policy director for Planned Parenthood.
And so, you know, when candidates for the court get up and give that speech on election night, they have a choice they can make. They can kind of withdraw from the campaign messages and thank their supporters and say it's time to move on. In this case, I think you heard Chris Taylor saying, hey, you know all that stuff I said on the campaign trail? That's still me. This is who I am. So knowing that, knowing the court that she is stepping into, what might this court take up?
I mean, so one of the things that could be on the agenda is a challenge to Act 10. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, I did a profile of Chris Taylor, and she talked about on the trail, on her stump speech, she talked about how, like, the events of 2011 is part of what motivated her to run for the legislature, which is part of where she spent her career, meaning Act 10, meaning the protests against Scott Walker. And so it'll be really interesting to kind of see the tail of those events and how those reshaped politics. Maybe it potentially come before this court.
Rich, any issues that you think could be there?
I mean, obviously, there's a ton of issues. But one thing that has been interesting to watch is the liberal majority kind of dismantling Republicans, the power that they had built up for themselves when they had, you know, they still do, but during the Walker years. And this has been through kind of clipping the wings a little bit of these various legislative committees that can delay new rules for agencies, or they could, indefinitely. And, you know, we've seen that sort of stuff get struck down. So I guess I'd be more interested to see if there's going to be other cases challenging the legislature's authority to be able to stop you know, things that Democrats want to see happen.
We're going to run out of time here if we don't keep moving. I think, you know, use your imagination. Big issues could come before the court. Let's talk about another person in the news this week who lost their job. The UW Board of Regents unanimously fired the assistant president, Jay Rothman. What do we know about why at this point?
Not much.
Right.
We know that they were displeased that he serves at the pleasure of the board. These are appointees of Governor Evers. Rothman came in kind of as a whisperer for Republicans. When Republicans control the legislature and the UW needed someone to negotiate between both parties, especially when the UW is getting trampled in the budget constantly. And it may signal this idea that we don't need someone like that anymore, that they expect Democrats to be in power next year when there's a new budget and Rossman's services. It's time for him to move on. They were hoping to do it quietly, but it didn't end up that way.
It didn't. And Republicans who control the legislature are not only protesting, they are using the power that they have potentially in the state Senate, it sounds like, to kind of strike back in a way.
Yeah, that is one of the powers that they've had throughout the Evers administration, is to push back against his appointments. And they could do that here to send a message. Again, we are kind of looking towards November where we don't know who's going to end up in the governor's seat. And so therefore, we don't know who's going to end up in charge of the Board of Regents. And so I think we're going to see some of this power grabbing right now in order to kind of set the stage for control of UW.
That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us for this week's Inside Wisconsin Politics.
That was WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org.
Coming up, a long-running UW-Stevens Point Trivia Marathon is next week. Student Frank Ross's family has fielded a team for decades. Now he's a question writer confronting his family firewall.
When I first became a writer, there was a lot of jokes about, Frank, you gotta give us some under-the-table clues here. Now it's turned into, Frank, what did you do this week? I can't really tell you.
That's next. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As the weather starts to warm up and spring takes hold in Wisconsin, cyclists will be setting out to enjoy the state by bicycle.
Some of them will be riding on a seat made by America's only leather bike seat manufacturer, which happens to be across the street from a cornfield in Elkhorn, Wisconsin.
Reporter Justin Barney has the story of the men who invented Sol Anatomica, a new kind of bike seat that now has a cult following.
The creator of Sol Anatomica was the late Tom Milton. He grew up in Detroit with a need for speed. His sister Carol, who runs the company now, says that it was in their blood.
My grandfather, Tommy Milton, was the first two-time winner of the Indy 500.
But instead of racing cars, Milton raced bikes.
He rode probably 4 to 6 hours every day. Oh. He lived to ride bikes.
But Milton was having trouble with his bike seat.
He rode a Brooks saddle.
If you're into biking, you know Brooks. They are the manufacturer of beautiful leather bike seats. The thing is, they can be uncomfortable while riding long distances. So Tom Milton took matters into his own hands.
He set out to develop a saddle that would be more comfortable.
So he hit the phone book, looking for people in the Midwest who made stuff with leather. And his eyes turned big as saucers when he saw the company Monarch McLaren in Elkhart, Wisconsin, founded by Ed Sylvester.
What he liked is our name is Monarch McLaren. And McLaren, fast cars.
That's what he liked?
Yes.
There was an issue, though. They didn't make bike seats. I met Sylvester at his factory in the Elkhart Industrial Park. Monarch McLaren makes leather seals and flanges for water well plunges and spray pumps. They're an industrial leather maker. Ed doesn't even ride bikes. But he's not one to pass up an opportunity. And in 2006, the two went into business.
Finally, I said, why not? Let's give it a shot.
But these two guys did not get along.
So we clashed.
Ed Sylvester is this practical leather worker with years of experience. And Tom Milton was this kind of harebrained schemer. He was insistent and uncompromising with this singular focus on how to engineer the perfect, comfortable leather bike seat.
I clash with engineers because I know what leather can do. They think they know what leather can do.
Milton's idea was the Cell Anatomica slot. To relieve the pressure on long rides, Milton simply wanted to cut a piece of leather out of the middle of the seat. And so they bought a Brooks seat, and that is exactly what they did.
That's how we started, modifying their seats with this padded slot. People loved it.
There was one group of people who didn't love it, though. The people at Brooks.
And they're like, what are you doing?
Really?
The impending threat of litigation served as useful inspiration to Ed Sylvester. And he created a whole new way to make a leather bike seat. It's a bit of a trade secret, but it's largely the way that they cure the leather. Brooks uses an old technique where they mold leather when it's cold and then they bake it, resulting in a rock-hard seat that breaks in over time. Sylvester's method is to mold while it's hot. The result is a leather that feels broken in on your first ride. Daryl McKenzie is a bike coach in San Diego, California.
I was shocked at how comfortable the saddle was.
Because of the slot and the broken-in feel, Cell Anatomica have garnered a cult following in the bike community over the past 20 years. Last year, I was in Japan at a local bike shop. I looked up on the wall, and there's Cell Anatomica, stamped and developed in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, available and embraced on the other side of the world. And Brooks, their big competitor, they started making a leather bike seat with a slot cut out of the middle.
Justin Barney brought us that story on Cell Anatomica.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton.
This is WPR News. Teams from around the country are preparing to match wits in a beloved tradition that dates back over a half century at UW-Stevens Point.
The world's largest trivia contest is a fundraiser for the college's student-run radio station. Here's how the contest went last year.
In first place, with 24,115 points, is Dad's Computers, Potassium Power.
For one student, this trivia contest was a big draw for why he wanted to attend UW-Stevens Point.
The family of Frank Ross, including his mom, his uncles, and grandparents, they established their trivia team in 1987.
That was long before Ross was born. They continue to field a team in this 54-hour marathon of questions.
And now, Frank Ross of Milton is fulfilling a lifelong dream by helping to write the hundreds of trivia questions. He is a UW-Stevens Point junior, majoring in business management, and volunteers at its student radio station. And he joins us now. Frank, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Can you run through some basic points on how this 54-hour marathon works with thousands of participants?
Yeah. Like you said, it's 54 hours straight for probably 52 of those 54 hours. It's 8 questions an hour. It's 2 songs. So the DJ on the air reads the question twice, plays a song usually about 2 minutes long, rereads the question, plays another 2 minute long song, and then closes the question, states the answer. And then, yeah, that repeats for eight times throughout all of those hours.
Wow. And so quite a marathon. How do you stay awake?
Coffee, coffee, energy drinks. Last year I was double fisting an energy drink and coffee at 4 a.m. on Sunday. So,
oh goodness. And hundreds of teams take part each year. Your family, it's, you know, has a nearly 4-decade connection to this trivia event. What makes it so special for generations of your family to come back and play year after year?
It's all about the family and friends. There's a lot of people. This is the only time I ever see them during the year. And so it being able, again, being able to spend time with them, see family. We have family from Illinois that comes up, Michigan that comes down. So it's really nice just to be able to see everyone and hang out for the weekend.
So how does your family prepare or get in shape for this contest? Are there any strategy sessions or pre-trivia, you know, brain workouts?
One thing during the contest is there's picture questions. So during within the rule book, each team gets a rule book. In there, there are 30 pictures, black and white pictures. And there's throughout the contest, there's going to be a question about each one of those pictures. The Wednesday before trivia, the Wednesday night before trivia, our team gets together on our chat rooms on the computer and goes through all of the pictures one by one. Hmm. Obviously, I can't take part in that anymore since I'm actually helping to run the contest. But that is one thing they did. The Friday before the contest, the Friday the week before the contest. So there's the trivia movie, which is a movie that's played here at the movie cinema in Stevens Point. And there's always several questions about that movie in particular. Our team always has a few people go to that, and then it's rewatched throughout the week leading up to trivia as well.
To make sure that all of the Easter eggs are found.
Correct, yes.
So now that you're a question writer, there's this firewall, right, with your family team and you on the other side of this event. How does that feel? Is it difficult?
It is a little bit. When I first became a writer, there was a lot of jokes about, Frank, you got to give us some under the table clues here. And I was like, no, I can't really do that. I'm sorry to say, but now it's turned into, Frank, what did you do this week? I can't really tell you.
Yeah, exactly. I was smitten because there's this picture of your mom holding you as a 9-month-old baby at your first trivia event. And yes. Obviously you don't remember, but what are your early memories of this trivia contest?
Yeah, so it's our team, their headquarters, we like to call it, is at my grandfather's house here in Stevens Point. And so family would come down from Michigan. And so my cousins and I, either my mom or one of my aunt or uncle, we would always go to get ice cream at Belts or to the park a couple blocks away. There was a huge pine tree there that we would always climb up, and my cousins would always ask, Frank, you want to go to the climbing tree? Are we going to go to the climbing tree today? So it's stuff like that. I didn't really play as much of the contest when I was younger, just because I didn't have an interest in it. But as I got older, that slowly grew and grew each year.
How did your family come up with the team name Gene Autry's Ninja Warriors? And has the name stuck through the decades?
So I'll just go through a little history here of the name from what I can recall. The first year, when it was just my mom, her brothers, and then my grandparents, the team was called the Joy of Trivia. Their last name is Joy. And then from there, it turned into the Gene Autry Fan Club. I don't really know why there was such a fondness of Gene Autry.
Back in the saddle again? I don't know.
Yes. And then from there, it turned into Gene Autry's Ninja Warriors. From what I have heard, it's because there was some years ago, years upon years ago, a couple decades ago, there was a big fad with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And so they just decided to smush the two together, and it turned into the Gene Autry's Ninja Warriors. And it's been like that for at least two decades without change.
You are helping to write like 428 questions. Is that
correct?
It? Yeah.
Yep.
So between the smartphone in our pocket, and now we've got the AI assisting us, does that change the calculus of question writing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, from what I've heard from writers in years past before the internet was a thing, you could have just gone in a book and pulled some random thing and barely anyone would have known that unless they had that exact book. Whereas now the internet made things so much easier to find, you have to be more specific about what you're asking for.
Do you and your fellow question writers, do you have a system for topics or figuring out what questions get green lit and get the go ahead?
All I can say is anything and everything is up for grabs for writing a question on.
You know, some teams have been participating since 1970. Other teams will be brand new this year. Do you have any advice for rookie trivia teams and what they're getting into here?
Yeah, I would say have books, because even though obviously we have the internet and there's so much on the internet, there's still a lot of stuff that you can't find on the internet and that it's only in books. There's a lot of books that were published, say, 50 years ago, and information could have changed since then, but there have been questions in the past where the previous writers have asked for, what was the record fish caught in 1967 or something like that? Because when you look it up on the internet, it's going to say whatever the best as of right now record is. Mm-hmm. Although what you're looking for is what was the record set in 1967. So being able to have that physical copy from when they first recorded it back then would be very helpful to have.
So someone on the team is going to have a home with a ton of books.
Yes, that is my grandfather's house. Yes.
That is your grandfather's house. You're a junior. Does your volunteerism at the student radio station and writing so many trivia questions, does it help in your academics or influence what you do next?
I would say it does take a lot of my time from my academics, unfortunately. But no, I mean, it allows me to think in different ways than some other students would. I mean, I can recall, in part because of this, the most tidbit information, whereas if I bring up something in front of my friends like that, they would have no idea what I'm talking about, or say, Frank, how did you know that?
Well, Frank, best of luck in the question writing. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That is Frank Ross, a business management major, and as a volunteer at the student radio station at UW-Stevens Point, Frank is helping to write the hundreds of questions for the world's largest trivia contest. It's set for April 17th through the 19th, and the competition will include Gene Autry's Ninja Warriors out in force made up of Frank's relatives. The theme for the 56th annual event is the Love Contest. It's a nod to celebrating love in pop culture and spending a weekend answering questions with people you love.
The head of the U.S. Postal Service tells Congress that service cuts or rate increases could be needed in the face of long-running budget concerns.
And on Monday, we'll dig into this issue and find out why rural Wisconsin has a lot at stake. And we'll visit a Milwaukee County community that's had recent concerns about mail and package delivery.
And we want to hear from you. How smoothly is the mail running in your community? How much do you rely on the Postal Service to deliver things like tax forms, medications, and more? What concerns or questions do you have about possible service cuts?
And if you are a current or former USPS employee, we'd certainly love to hear your perspective.
Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Mackenzie Crummy and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Tim Peterson is our managing producer, and Dean Kinetter is our executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.